Hey, everybody. Good day. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Here with my two partners in crime, as always, Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge. You're an assistant to the assistant manager, or were you the assistant director? If you've never watched The Office, you need to watch The Office so you can understand that. Wade is now a manager on our SIU investigative team. And of course, Matt Kachansky, who apparently is in an igloo in his basement working because it is chilly in Maryland. Matt, retired special agent in charge from the OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC director, and our program director here of our payment integrity team. So today, we want to follow up on the conversation that we had last week regarding provider abrasion from the investigative perspective and then from that negotiation perspective. I had an interesting conversation the other day with someone who is an SIU investigator at a small plan. I think she may have been only one or two investigators at that plan. So a lot of responsibilities in the government Medicare Advantage and commercial Medicaid space, you know, a couple of different lines of business. But while I was chatting with her, she referenced the fact that she had tuned into our podcast from last week. And so many of the things that we talked about resonated with her relative to the whole premise of where that provider abrasion issue comes from. And she deals with that on a very regular basis and thought that it was pretty interesting that it was commonplace in the industry. And so we wanted to kind of follow up on that because the piece of the puzzle that we wound up having a conversation about was where in the provider abrasion continuum, you know, does it start? And, you know, as we talked about last week, we talked about the intersection of the need of the SIU to obtain medical records and do those reviews and then identify the overpayment and then negotiate a settlement if there is an overpayment to be made, if there is a settlement to be made, you know, where we're not talking about necessarily an appeal or anything like that. And, you know, one of the biggest things that had come out of that conversation was this ongoing discussion. I thought we had beaten this horse dead, but apparently not, is this ongoing discussion about your methodology for sampling and having sound methodology principles for obtaining records. And the big thing we always talk about is probe sampling, statistically valid random sampling. Or if you look at the Program Integrity Manual, Chapter 8, they talk about SSOE, which is statistical sampling and overpayment estimation. And part of this is having a staff or having access to people who understand this. You know, if you don't have a statistician on staff, it's having access to a statistician. You know, we have a master's level CMS trained biostatistician here. We have a PhD level statistician here who comes from MIT and Yale and is a, you know, mathematician, statistician, and understands a lot of these. And that's a lot of the work that when we're doing a lot of these, we're spending time working on methodologies. So Wade, the first piece, because you've got RATSTATS on your laptop, you're ingesting billing data, you're running RATSTATS for sampling, you know, and the big thing is, at the end of the day, from an investigative planning perspective, you have to think in terms of, as part of your investigative process, is it better to do a probe sample of 30? Is it better to do a statistical sample, which minimum data set is 100, but it's typically more depending upon that universe? You know, should it be stratified? And we don't want to even get into the vernacular of what stratifying a sample is and, you know, different ways of calculating that methodology. But understanding that when a provider appeals on a statistical sample, there's two areas of attack. The first place that a defense attorney will attack is going to be the methodology. And then the second part, if the methodology has been proven to be accurate, is going to be the review itself. Because if you've come up with an error rate that's extrapolated, you only need to find one claim that you have a disagreement with. It's a little bit like a jury trial, right? The government needs to have everybody on one side. A defense attorney only needs to convince one person. It's a similar thing in statistical sampling. The defense only needs to, the provider appealing that audit only needs to find an issue with one claim because that puts the entire sampling error rate into a tizzy. So Wade, it's a lot to unpack, but I don't want to go crazy with this, but certainly as part of that investigative planning, your case planning, your case, you know, how you're doing your case, a lot of that is going to include a discussion about what is a sound methodology, whether it be a probe sample, statistical sample, and at what point does Wade have to realize that this is not Wade's lane anymore?
Right. Yeah, there's two key ideas there to unpack that are very important. One is to, as the investigator, to have a thorough understanding of kind of the whole process and the theory behind the sampling, know the difference between a probe and a random stratified sample, and when you would use those, as you said. But really the key is to know when it is out of your lane. Like for example, I used RATstats. I took RATstats training back in the early 90s and worked with it with the OIG. But at that point, I didn't run RATstats myself. I had a good understanding of why we used it and how we used it. But when I needed a RATstats sample, I went to our Office of Audit because those auditors had more experience with it than I did. So I would get a sample, I would explain what I want, and I would get a sample from them and then work with it. Now in the SIU work, I'll actually run the samples using RATstats. I have a good understanding of why we do it, how we do it, what the purpose is, the end result, what you're looking for. But when you get to the point, as you were saying, where it's an audit and they're questioning the methodology, that's beyond I can't answer to that. I answer to why we're using it, how we use it, that type of thing. But when we get into the I'm not a statistician. When we get into that level of needing explanation, I have to back off and go to our experts that we have. And I think that's as important as, well, it's more important to know that as opposed to trying to fake it till you make it and start, even if you have a somewhat of an understanding and you kind of think you know at that point, if it's beyond your level of expertise, you have to pass it on to the statisticians and have them come with the true, accurate, thorough answers as opposed to kind of winging it and hoping you can get by. So it's as much as anything, it's knowing what your limitations are, work within your limitations as far as generating that sample, knowing why you have the sample, relating it to what your end goal is. Maybe it's a probe sample, maybe it's a statistical sample. But keep your use of that sample and the whole process within your expertise and know when you have to pass it on.
Yeah, and the other piece of this puzzle is making sure that when and if the time comes to have to explain it, that if you're not the right person, that we you whoever it may be has access to the right person to be able to explain it. So because at the end of the day on an appeal there's going to be a challenge to that methodology in some cases, and so it is important to be able to explain it if that methodology is in fact challenged versus the results of the audit. So yeah, you can't just kind of you just kind of can't kind of wing it, right? And so Matt, now we get to the next piece, which is from a management leadership position. Some of the frustrations that I've heard from people that we talk to in the industry are either a combination of lack of buy-in by leadership for this kind of level of expertise. And again, you don't always need a master's level statistician. You don't always need a PhD level statistician. What you do need is a master's level statistician or a PhD level statistician when you have a case that might have levels of complexities or what have you. And again, this whole premise of a penny wise and a pound foolish isn't going to go very far.
Right. Yeah, let's take this back one step. I want to go like follow up on Wade's stuff, both from a management point of view and from a provider abrasion point of view, because that that was the germ of this. Every SIU has a continuum of remedies available to them. And it's up to the manager and the investigator, based on the facts of the case, the fact, the allegation, what the data is saying, the program integrity history of the provider that they're looking at, the types of issues that they're looking at, as to what remedy to use. So when you get that allegation, a manager's got to know what's the end game here? Do we want this provider to stay in and educate them, or do we want them to know that they've done something wrong and ratchet this thing up to where it's not punitive, but at least they understand they have to change their behavior? And I think, you've got a continuum of remedies to do that. You have education letters. You've got a small probe sample to show them, as part of the education. Here's a small overpayment. Learn from this. Check them again in 6 months. if they've, you know, if there's a history with those people, or it's a large, not technical error, but something pervasive in the data that's showing you that they might purposely be doing this, then you start looking at the stratified samples and perhaps prepays and things like that, and you tailor those remedies to the provider, so you're not shooting the bunny with the elephant gun, causing provider abrasion. Because why are you hitting me right. for 500, you know, line items when it's a technical issue? That's a mistake. It's a mistake. So you don't want to do that. The second part of that is
that a little bit of that is coming from the vetting process. Like, what's the allegation here?
Absolutely.
My other question, Matt, is what do you think about the premise of that if the case is above a certain dollar amount or below a certain dollar amount, that's going to be a driving factor about whether you're doing probe sampling or statistical sampling? If you're talking about a case of a couple hundred thousand dollars, does a statistical sample make sense versus a case that could be, you know, three, four, five, whatever that number is, something, you know, $1 billion, whatever it may be.
Yeah, the dollars play into it. The length of time it's been going on play into it. All of those are factors. And as a manager, you've got to work with the investigators on your staff on how to look at those factors to make those decisions together. But to your point then, for each of those remedies, for each of those methodologies, whether it be a probe sample, whether it be the statistical sample, you need to have in place a consistent process and method for effectuating them. You can't treat one probe sample differently from another one. It's got to be done the same way. The facts may be different, the claim types might be different, but your process has to be the same to be defensible. No, and that is, you know, for statistical sampling, it's even 10 times higher than that, because the methodology is the key to any type of appeal, as you said. So, you know, having rat stats is great, but rat stats by itself being used by an investigator to do a complex multi-frame stratified sample, no way. You need to have available the people that know how to do those things and people that know how to defend those things in front of the ALJ or whatever avenue it might take. Those things are absolutely necessary. So you need consistency, you need policies and procedures in place, and you need the personnel, even fractionally, that can handle those things when they're needed, so that at the end, the appropriate remedy was done, it was done well, it's defensible, and the provider perhaps then understands why they're in the situation they are, thus, you know, perhaps lowering that abrasion just because they're sick of being, you know, the aggrieved party, you know, showing them that you did something right. wrong and we did it the right way.
And part of this is also the fact that if there is a challenge, you've got to have the right people available to provide the commentary, you know, yes. I mean, to do this and then not have the people on the back end to provide the commentary. And I think, you know, for your lower level rat stats analyses, where, you know, it's a pretty straightforward, it's a 1 year period of time where rat stats is kind of self-explanatory on that. But, you know, when you start getting into these cases that could be multi-year, multi-million dollar, where you're starting to get a little bit more complicated in how that statistical sampling is being
different
done.
Different policies were in effect throughout those years. So those are different frames each way. It's right. There's many things you could take into account.
It becomes a big challenge and it becomes a metric that you've got to consider. Particularly because when a provider is seeking to appeal, and oftentimes I think, you know, where I've sat in and some of us have sat in on some of these meetings with providers is it's not even necessarily to challenge, it's to understand. I mean, I think last week I was on a call with a provider where the provider just wanted to understand how did I get to the point where I owe $500,000 or whatever that number was. How did I get to, I don't understand. How do I owe, didn't understand it. Like, you know, doctors practice medicine. They're not always people who understand statistics or research in that sense. So that becomes a piece of the puzzle, is to be able to find people who have the ability to articulate how you got from point A to point B in a short period of time and got to this, you know, because it's going to go from requesting records to an overpayment letter within a short period of time, right? So you have to be able to get to that. So wait, I want to go back to you for the last word, because what winds up happening is Matt is sitting in his ivory tower managing things and not kind of in the weeds. And you're the one that's doing these reviews, these investigations. You know, you're that line person. And having the ability to have that conversation, and we talked about this last week, control the conversation, not control the narrative, because the narrative is what it is, but it's the conversation. What are some of the, you know, what are some of the areas where, you know, you think that investigators need to really be sharp? Where are the areas where, when you're getting ready for these meetings, what's the investigator got at, like, back of the hand, they got to know this stuff?
Well, I think the first thing is to do, you know, as much research as you can, so you're prepared for, you know, kind of predict the questions that you're going to have to answer and do the research so you can have answers to those questions. But even more so, this is kind of going back to what we were saying before, as much as, or even more so than knowing the answers, is knowing when you don't know the answer or where to go for the answer. So, you know, brush up and so you're able to answer as much as possible, you know, do your research. But again, going back to the don't try and fake it till you make it. If you don't know, say, it's just like when you're testifying, if you don't know, don't make some stuff up. Say, I don't know that. And this is, you know the person to go to, whether it be your manager, the SIU director, maybe the statistician, depending on what the subject matter is. Know your limitations. Try and get your knowledge up as high as you can and be, you know, competent in your position, but know when it's out of your lane and know where to go to get the correct answer, the appropriate answer, I think is the key.
Yeah. And we recently did some training for a plan, and they were using RatStats. They've never had official or formal training on how to use it from anyone. It was like a recipe from your Nona. It was passed down from generation to generation. They had nothing in writing. Now, obviously, they had RatStats. They had the RatStats guide. But they didn't have any sort of summary document. And it was really one of these deals where they had no formal training, no official training. And besides that, the people that were using RatStats today were trained. It was like generational. So they were 3-4 layers removed from the original statistician that they had, who doesn't even exist anymore. So the plan, and it's a big plan, they didn't have a statistician even fractionally, like, you know, on call kind of a deal. They had nothing. And they were running RatStats, and their rationale for why they didn't ever get formal training or why they didn't have a statistician that they had access to was because they had never had a challenge. And my response was, well, you know, we put batteries in a flashlight in a drawer, not because we need to turn the flashlight on now, but we have fresh batteries for when we need to turn the flashlight on, right? It's a similar, you know, it's kind of like you're being a prepper. You're hoping for the best, but preparing for the worst. And my response was, well, why don't you at least have an agreement in place with, and we do a ton of work for this plan, and we didn't have that as part of our line item, but we looked to put that in, was if you never need it and you never use it, it's fine. But in case of emergency, break glass and break out statistician. It's like you need to have somebody lined up, because what you don't want to do is be in a position where you're trying to defend the indefensible. And the problem, unfortunately, as a society we run into, is people want to take a position, and even if that position is 100% wrong, try to fight to the death to defend a position. There's very, you know, the humility is just, we're kind of gone from that, right? If there's a mistake, you got to own up to that mistake, because it's, in the end, it winds up being very bad. If you have a mistake in something, and the provider seeks to take that to the mat, what you've done collaterally is you've now put out into the public realm your exposure and weakness. And the provider community, we know this, the provider community all speak to each other. A lot of lawyers in certain sectors of the provider community are in the same circle. You know, you see it quite often where the same lawyers are representing providers in the same kind of matters. And that's not a bad thing, because if the lawyer realizes that there's a problem, they're representing their client to the best interest of their client to fix a, what winds up being in some cases, a systemic problem, and not you know, and from the plan's perspective, you can fix that by fixing whatever that, you know, that problem might be. So there's a lot of challenges that are out there, but you know, it doesn't always have to result in an inordinate cost to the plan. I think at the end of the day, if a provider has a $1 million overpayment and they want to fight it, the cost of fighting it is going to far exceed having just done the work the right way in the beginning, right? So penny wise, pound foolish, particularly with budgets being pretty flat right now in the industry. You know, we're seeing a lot of plans laying people off, their auditors, their investigators, and they're trying to, I hate to say it, but they're trying to do more with less, which you can't do. But that becomes a piece of the puzzle. So for me, the conversation the other day was very eye-opening. In part, I was very appreciative of the fact that this individual, you know, had a lot of comments to make about our discussion last week, but it really did spark a whole other set of conversation. And I think we're probably going to continue to have those conversations. So as always, complicated issues. The SIU space is very complicated. And anybody who thinks that it's not should kind of revisit what they're doing, because it is a very complicated. The moving parts are inordinate and ever-changing, and priorities change and all of that. So we just got to keep focused on what the mission of the SIU is. So important stuff. As always, good to see you guys. Good to get insights from both of you. Stay warm through the rest of the winter. Thanks to everybody who's tuning in to our LinkedIn Lives. We just had one the other day, with Gene Stone, National Treasure Gene Stone. If you missed it, you can catch it on our YouTube channel, Spotify, our website. We've got it all up there, our YouTube channel. And if you don't get our newsletter, you can get it from signing up. Just go to advise at advizehealth.com. You can get the newsletter delivered right to your inbox, as well as catching us on LinkedIn. You'll get each week's podcast right there in LinkedIn. So good seeing you guys. Thanks everybody for joining us. And we'll see you next week on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you all.
Thank you.